This is Teachers Talk Radio, and you are listening live.
And welcome to Teachers Talk Radio. Tonight, we are in the company of Emily Randall-Jones, award-winning author of children's books. I'm going to talk about neurodiversity and creativity. And hopefully, fingers crossed, we're going to have an absolutely fabulous night. So, all here tonight on Teachers Talk Radio.
This is Teachers Talk Radio, and you are listening live. Tune in live at ttradio.org, or to join in the conversation, download the Podbean app and search Teachers Talk Radio. Follow the hashtag TTRadio. Tune in, talk it out with Teachers Talk Radio.
So hello and welcome this Friday evening. And tonight we're talking to Emily Randall-Jones, a neurodiverse author and award-winning author. And we're going to be talking about neurodiversity and school and creativity and writing and all that sort of stuff. So, Emily, how are you?
I'm really good. How are you?
Not too bad, thank you very much. It's been quite a cold April. I don't know whether it's been the same down at your end, but it's certainly quite cold over here at the moment.
We've had literally all four seasons in one day today. It's been raining, it's been hailing, it's been glorious sunshine. I've got no idea what's going on.
Yes, I know. It's as mixed up as everything else is at the minute. Brilliant. So let's get straight on then and straight into it. So my first question is always my first question, and that is, what is your favourite book or children's book and why?
So as any neurodivergent person will tell you, this is a difficult question to answer. Do I have my favourite book right now, or favourite book when I was little, or favourite book when I'm sad? But in the end, I think I went firstly with Little Women, ultimately, by Louise May Alcott. That, to me, that book is home, if you know what I mean, like that. I loved it so much because it was about this kind of this big family that I didn't have, and I had a very lovely family, but it was a small family, and they were so creative and joyous, and that stayed with me ever since. But I'd say my favourite children's book nowadays is probably Stormkeeper's Island by Catherine Doyle. It's brilliant.
Okay, so an interesting book. To be fair, and I probably have to say this, my pride group at school absolutely love Little Women, and we had an argument about this the other day because it's a book that I had to read at university as one of my feminist kind of modules. And it's a book that took me a long time to read because I kept on having to put it down because, for me, it starts off obviously by their father reading a letter from their father, and then they practically do exactly the same. And the one person for me that had any kind of gumph, Joe, seems to kind of fizzle out towards the end. But I can certainly see my pride group absolutely loved it, and they slaughtered me. They were arguing with me for about an hour about how great it is.
I totally see what you mean about Joe fizzling out, and I think that was one of the things they kind of tackled in the Greta Gerwig film adaptation, didn't they? It was really well done, that, I thought. It's definitely, I think her character is so strong for, like, not officially, but so many neurodivergent girls particularly relate to her growing up, I think.
Yeah. Okay, so brilliant. So let's start off with then. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself and about your context, please?
Yeah, so I'm a writer. Like you said, I'm also an ex-actor. I was also a historical interpreter for a little bit at Hampton Court. And so I've had kind of a myriad of jobs throughout my life. I was diagnosed with ADHD at the age of 36, so 2 years ago, after a kind of lifetime of feeling like I didn't get the manual that everyone else seemed to get. And seeing the same kind of patterns in every part of my life, like in jobs, relationships, and everything else, like, you know, where it would go really well for a little bit and then kind of fall apart, and just thought it was a personality flaw, really, that I was lazy. And then, when I was diagnosed, I was like, oh my gosh, right, okay. this explains everything. I'm still processing it now. Interestingly, so I've been on medication for that for a couple of years, and it's been in the past year, and apparently this is quite common, what I believe now to be a sort of autism traits are potentially a kind of, as I'm unmasking, a kind of, I'm picking that as well. So I'm on currently on a waiting list, and I've just been referred to that. So yeah, it's that's not official yet, but yeah, it's been a couple of years for ADHD.
Wow. So it's kind of been, you had kind of a rough time of it, thinking lots of stuff, and then suddenly, because obviously neurodiversity has got a lot more kind of press recently, and it's certainly one of those things that it's much more high profile than it used to be. Can you in terms of neurodiversity, can you tell us a little bit about neurodivergence, kind of what it is, what makes it different to those who aren't neurodivergent?
Yeah, so I mean, again, with the disclaimer that I'm not an expert, so do forgive me if I get sort of wildly inaccurate, but it's kind of it's a way that the brain is wired kind of differently from those who are kind of quote unquote neurotypical, who kind of fit the societal norm, if you like. So including but not limited to ADHD, which is attention deficit hyperactive disorder, ASD, which is the autism spectrum disorder, dyslexia, dyscalculia, dyspraxia. Difference in kind of behaviors and processing. And what's kind of interesting, particularly with the first two, is that the word disorder is in there. But there is a lot of kind of, there's an argument from a lot of sides saying that it's just, you know, think of it as a disorder is kind of doing our brains a disservice. And actually, this is the way our brains are wired. It just doesn't necessarily fit in with the way that society is right now.
Yeah, I mean, certainly one of the things I think that's come up in terms of neurodivergence at the moment is females and autism. I think because if I remember correctly, because it was in the 1950s and most of the subjects that were looked at in terms of autism were boys, the kind of how they diagnose it is more to do with what boys are like. And so therefore now there is nowhere near as many autistic diagnoses for girls, but that's kind of changing at the moment. I don't know whether you've heard that at the moment.
Yeah, and absolutely. And even now, like when this has kind of come to light, and I've my GP was like, yes, you've done enough to refer you. I'm still reading the typical, stereotypical autism traits and going, oh no, that's not me, I can't be, because that's, I'm very communicative and I don't particularly like trains and all these kind of really stereotypical things that are like listed still nowadays. And there's such a hangover of people still believing that those are what kind of autistic traits are, which of course there are some people who do present like that, but it is a spectrum, and there's so many different ways, particularly in girls who are, without getting too sort of feminist, kind of often more encouraged to kind of conform a little bit more, I think, and to kind of we tend to mask earlier on, I think. I know that's certainly the case for me. So yeah, it takes us a lot longer, I think, to kind of unpick what that looks like.
Brilliant. So tonight then we're talking about kind of neurodivergency in its all of its nuances, in terms of school, in terms of creativity and writing. So one of the things I'm going to start off with is, do you think that maybe teachers need to know more about neurodiversity than they already do? And do you think that this would help students kind of in schools, having those knowledgeable teachers, those ones that know neurodiversity a lot better?
It's a really difficult one, because I know, obviously I'm not a teacher, but I my teacher's dad is a teacher, and I kind of, I saw firsthand how stretched teachers are, and how, the amount that you have got to kind of have on your plate already. The capabilities that just isn't there. But I think probably a huge gap in knowledge, and not for lack of interest or wanting to try, but I think particularly when it comes to the less, like we were talking about, the less stereotypical presentations, like the high masking stuff, for example, I was often told I was too much for teachers. I was too in my own head. I was late. I sort of handed homework in late a lot of the time. I would skip lessons because I was overwhelmed. I would cry if I was given feedback, with these really big emotions. And that was just, you could tell there was this kind of annoyance there a little bit, that I was just this kind of frustrating student. Again, this was, you know, a good 20 odd years ago. And like with my daughter, for example, she's only five, but she was referred to by her nursery to go to the GP because she walks on her toes, which is a common trait to autistic people. And straight away, the GP, who was lovely, have nothing against the GP, she said, oh, they sent her here because they're, you know, they're concerned about communication and developmental issues, but she's clearly fine because she's very chatty. Mm. And that was it. And it was like, actually, and now we are at the stage now, several years later, where we're referring her because she doesn't present typically at all. And so having, I think, what is needed is more training in the kind of the atypical presentation and what that looks like. But actually, I'm going to kind of go through this, like some of the answers to your other questions.
Okay.
I think the key to it with the, you know, with the lack of kind of space and time that teachers do have is actually encouraging students to learn more about themselves in almost kind of like a, so something I encourage I've got a neurodivergent writers group, and we have a kind of know yourself document, which is where you write, it's a bit like DBT, where you write down, you know, what your triggers are, what you find difficult, you know, what your favourite things are, what the things you like to write about, all this kind of stuff. And so even if the teachers don't necessarily have that capability to, you know, to kind of help a student at any particular time, if the student has kind of that toolkit where they start to know more about themselves, then that, you know, that can only be for the good.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely brilliant. I'd never thought of it from that perspective before, because when I was thinking of the kind of questions that I thought that I would ask you, it never came into my mind that to have the students kind of learn more about themselves so that they have that knowledge, they have that understanding that, as you said, the feelings of frustration and anxiety that you have as a child, if you know more about the condition that you have, then perhaps that anxiety can be less, because you can perhaps know the things that are going on inside of you. You can then talk to perhaps the teacher and ask them if they can do this or do that, or if, and it, that it's not you. Like that's something that's a very, I've literally just written that down on my notepad. It's like, that's brilliant. I'm certainly going to start to think about that myself. So that kind of brings me really nicely into the next question, which is about challenges. So what sort of challenges then, apart from that lack of knowledge, which I think, you know, getting those students to actually have that knowledge is great, but what challenge do you think that neurodiverse students face, do you think?
So I think even, you know, with all the understanding in the world, the school environment can't suit everybody. You know, there's, I know I grew up in a school where a lot of our classrooms were in mobile classrooms, which the temperatures are like, you know, boiling hot in summer and freezing in winter. And, you know, there's these bright kind of lights, there's dead flies on the windowsill. You know, there's uncomfortable seats, there's noises, people chatting. Yeah. It's, you know, all of this stuff, because, you know, we experience like processing, so like it was, you're just so highly sensitive to so many kind of sensory things that can make your head feel really buzzy, like it's, you know, like you're about to explode. And you know, you've got all of that to contend with, just to try and kind of, you know, deal with that. And then on top of that, you know, the school environment is so important to conform at that, you know, that age. I think that's, and as a neurodivergent person, that's one of the hardest things to do, unless you are one of those rare people that are very comfortable in your own skin and, you know, like very happy with who you are. You know, you've got this kind of social anxiety that's kind of there all the time, and you don't want to kind of stand out particularly or look too different. And, you know, you kind of add all this to all the overwhelm of, you know, what the lessons are and homework and, you know, hormones and everything. That's just kind of a big melting pot of, you know, sensory overwhelm, really.
Yeah, I mean, that's really interesting, especially kind of putting that sense of all of those kind of sensory issues on top of that conformity, because you know, you don't want to stand out in class. I mean, it's certainly one thing that you notice as a teacher is when you ask a question and not a single person puts their hand up, because no one wants to be noticed. So yeah, having all of that on top of wanting to not stand out, so I suppose that also, going back to what you said last time, may also be difficult, because even if they know about themselves and know what they can and can't do, it's still quite difficult to tell the teacher, because again, they don't want to stand out. Wow, that's really difficult. Yeah, it's an interesting point. Sorry, carry on.
No, it's because, you know, it's really, really difficult, because because there's sensory stuff. There is, you know, the sensory stuff that you do kind of hear about from, neurodivergent children who really need, like, you know, ear defenders, and who really struggle with, you know, and stimming and that kind of thing, and fidget toys. But that there are also kind of sort of lower level sensory stuff that I wouldn't even notice in myself had I not sat down and thought about what it was, you know, like the prickliness of a uniform or something like that. You add all of that, and it's just, you know, that's the stuff that kind of just can take you out of whatever you're doing at that particular time. And also, like, and one thing I meant to say as well is verbal processing. A lot of, you know, I think, you know, things well much, you know, may well have changed since then, but I had a lot of teachers who would just like to talk at me, you know, particularly as we kind of got to kind of later on, sort of year 12, 13. And it would just go over my head, and I tried to make notes, but my brain would get distracted, and I draw pictures of, like, aliens in my history books. And you know, I think that awareness that verbal processing just doesn't work for a lot of us. Like, I really appreciated you sent some instructions on how to join over. That was fantastic. It was like, it was so beautifully presented, you know, and I was like, yes, I know exactly what to do now, because I can, you know, I can kind of compare it. But yeah, verbal processing doesn't work for a lot of us.
Okay, so for what we're saying is, for neurodivergent students, it's kind of there needs to be things other than the teacher talking at them. They need to have different stimulus in order to help them to remember.
Yeah, I would say so. And I'm sure there are kind of several different options of what that is. But I think, you know, particularly, like, I remember some instructions with coursework, and there is a fear quite often of asking, you know, if you don't understand something, like you said. I remember doing some math coursework and not knowing until literally the day before what the coursework actually was, and being too scared to ask, because she kind of explained it, you know, in a verbal way, and it was just that once. And so, yeah, you know, whether that be kind of like, you don't even use whiteboards, you've got magic stuff now, haven't you, like whatever the magic boards are. You know, or like, you know, a handout that actually people can go away and study in their own time, you know, an email or whatever, however people do things these days, just in their, you know, and can sit there and study in their own time and process it, because it can take us a lot longer, I think.
Brilliant, great advice. And we'll come back to the next question in a second.
I've always considered myself to be a caring head teacher who acts sensitively to support staff mental health. But what I found increasingly difficult was managing the negative impact on staff mental health when resolving issues related to their employment or daily work. Heartfelt Leadership has been developed by TeachWell Toolkit as a handbook to support headteachers to overcome the challenges of school improvement while supporting staff well-being. We know that difficult conversations can quickly turn into conflict if procedures are not fully transparent, understood, and followed. Our handbook takes you through step-by-step processes while maintaining mutual respect, avoiding conflict, and finding solutions.
At Bloomsbury Education, we're passionate about supporting teachers with high-quality professional development books from leading experts. Whether you're navigating your first crucial years as an early career teacher, or a more experienced teacher looking to refresh your practice or take a step up into leadership, our award-winning books are here to help. We publish practical books to support teaching across primary and secondary, from the very best in research-led practice to trusted advice on inclusivity, behaviour and curriculum design. Visit the Bloomsbury Education website at bloomsbury.com/education to find out more, and use code BLOOMTTR24 to save 20% on all education titles. Bloomsbury Education, books for every step of your teaching journey.
And welcome back. We are talking to Emily Randall-Jones about neurodiversity, and especially within, in terms of creativity. So before, we've just been talking about what neurodivergence is, and also about kind of how knowledgeable teachers need to be into neurodiversity and how that can help, and also the challenges, which I found really, really interesting, especially the verbal processing one. I thought that was great. So my next question, Emily, is how then might that neurodivergence affect a student who maybe, say, has to write, whether creatively or like a non-fiction piece?
I would say it's really hard. I mean, it's one of the things I love about writing and always have. It's I can lose myself in it. That's always been my happy, fuzzy place. And it's kind of impossible to lose yourself in that kind of creative place, you know, if you are uncomfortable in your environment. You know, even like now, you know, as a professional writer, I've got to have the window open, even if it's freezing. If I've got fresh air, I've got to have white noise playing. I've got to be sit on a comfy chair. I have to have three different drinks. Very important. You know, I have to have kind of like pictures on the wall of what I'm doing, just to kind of really immerse myself in my world. And obviously, if it's the kind of antithesis of that, and you are insanely uncomfortable, that's really hard to kind of, you know, let yourself sink into writing, I think, and that's going to affect a lot of it.
Okay, so that would also be then, when we talked about the challenges and those sensory issues, the verbal processing, the chairs that aren't very comfortable. You just neurodivergent students then are just in a far, not worse, a far less comfortable place than neurotypical people. I know that lots of our neurotypical students complain about the chairs anyway. So what you're saying is, for neurodivergence, in order to concentrate on that creative process, it's far more challenging. Is that right?
Yeah, I would say that they are starting from a different place. They are starting, like, they've got a different starting line that's, you know, it's sort of way further back than anyone else. Like right now, I'm talking to you, I'm sitting on the floor. And I sit on the floor a lot of the time, and I've got many neurodivergent friends who first sit on the floor. For some reason, it's just more comfortable. And it's the stuff that you kind of, you know, in your home environment, or sort of as you get older, you know, if you're in a position where you can kind of fit your work around it, you learn to adapt. But if those accommodations aren't necessarily available, you know, it's going to be harder and harder to kind of to work to your best.
So in that case then, would it be for a neurodivergent student a better idea for teachers to maybe allow neurodivergent students to kind of plan and work on what they might write during the lessons, and then allow them to perhaps do the actual physical writing of it at home where they're much more comfortable, do you think?
That's a really, really good point. And I have to say also the library is a really comfortable neurodivergent space. I don't want to speak, you know, as a generalization, but for me, but also for many other neurodivergent people I know, the library is a calm haven. And if for whatever reason, even home isn't the right place for whatever reason, then, you know, getting to work there was where I did my best stuff, you know. It's like going into bookshops for me. It's not even that it's books, it's just something about the environment that is calm and soft, and it's lovely, and that kind of was fantastic. But I think potentially, if there's that kind of ability to work in a place that they feel comfortable, whatever that looks like, whilst obviously this is another difficult one, and this is where the kind of the student ideally knowing themselves helps, because obviously for some ADHD people, you know, getting going to work at home might not do it at that point if there's not someone there to keep them either. So it's a really difficult one. There's no one size fits all, really. It's all about, I think, getting to know your students, getting to know themselves, about, you know, being honest about how they're going to work best, and maybe trying to share that as best that they can with the teacher.
Okay, that's brilliant. And just an additional add on to that question, do you think it would be a good idea, because it's just popped into my head and I have no idea why, if neurodivergent students had something that they could have in the classroom to make it more comfortable when they're writing, such as, I don't know, something like a cushion to bring and put on a chair to make it more comfortable? Do you think that would work maybe? Or do you think putting their coat on the chair to make it more comfortable, so they're sitting on it? I'm just trying to think for my classroom practice, is there something that I could do or the students could do that would make that better for them?
Speaking of someone who again hasn't really stepped foot in a classroom in a long time, and might not be, you know, allowed or what have you, I do think having that kind of personal touch is really important. Having that bit of you, in fact, all of it, and I'll kind of talk about this in a bit, but having in writing completely, having that bit of you in an environment that can sometimes feel like you're lost and you don't know who you are, would make all the difference, I think. You know, that kind of comfort item, whatever that might be. And also something I was thinking of as well, is with ADHD particularly, body doubling is a really fantastic way of getting work done for me. So you work at the same time as someone, you pair off, and you kind of you don't even have to kind of like compare or anything, just know that they're there and you're doing it together. So like pairing people off sometimes, you know, it's quite fun. And also listening to music, because with ADHD people particularly, we have to, or like white noise or something, we need something to kind of kick off the dopamine in a task that we don't enjoy. So if we're not feeling it, if we've got something to kind of keep us distracted, that's going to, you know, that helps immensely as well. So yeah, to sum up what you're saying, yes, the kind of that slice of comfort, whatever that looks like for that individual student, I think would help immensely.
Okay, brilliant. So I talked in that question about creatively or non-fiction, so either a narrative or non-fiction. So do you think narrative or non-fiction writing is easier for students who are neurodivergent, and why do you think that?
I think again, this is probably a cop-out answer, but no one size fits all. One of these, you know, the kind of, if you meet one autistic person, you know, like there are people who would, you know, really happily talk about their special interests, whatever that might be, and, you know, insert that into their work, you know, until the cows come home, and logic can be very, very important as well, you know, but there are other people that ability to kind of escape into their brain and, like, you know, walk around in this world and create something totally new, that's their, you know, that's what is easier for them as well. So I'm sorry, that's a bit of a common answer. But I think the one thing I'll say is that if the opportunity to bring in special interest to whatever your work is invaluable. So I am one of my two special interests at school, I did it was old Hollywood, and for geography project we had to design a theme park at the Docklands, and I created an old Hollywood film studio, and for history coursework I didn't get a break mark, but I wrote about Anna Anderson, who was the woman who claimed to be Anastasia Romanov, you know, and actually I don't think I'd have done that work if the kind of the parameters were so closed that I wasn't able to choose that, if that makes sense. So
yeah,
it does,
yeah, that does,
you know,
make sense.
Yeah, yeah. So, so I think actually, in that sense, that kind of that nonfiction writing, I think can really benefit some students who want to share, you know, what kind of their knowledge is, I think.
Yeah, brilliant. I think actually reading that question, and I'm thinking about what I said earlier about the research into kind of autism and that the diagnosis in terms of boys. I think that's I've just noticed kind of one of my slight unknown biases of myself, because I thought that the answer to that was going to be kind of non-fiction, and that's generally because the boys who are neurodivergent in my classes generally tend to prefer writing non-fiction than narrative. And for me, it's made me, as you were saying, that no one size fits all. It made me think, you know, did I think that because that's the majority of what my autistic children in my school like to write, not actually thinking about maybe because I don't think, and I'm trying to rack my brain now, I don't think there are any female autistic students in my actual teaching classes, and so there I can't make that comparison to see whether or not that is different for females than it is for males. So wow, that question's got to put that up for me.
Oh, that's really interesting. I mean, and I'm exactly the same. I think that, you know, there's so much stuff in terms of internal bias, like, you know, we've all got it. I think it's inevitable with everything that we've been kind of taught over the past few years. But yeah, like I know, like particularly like with my daughter, her kind of her way with words and her escape into stories, you know, the way there's you know, the beautiful descriptions in some books about how autistic people use sensations to describe rather than metaphors. They'll talk about something being like, if someone's kind of being evasive, they'll talk about them being like slippery behind glass. Yeah. And it's not like a metaphor, it's a sensation. And that's how, like, whenever I'm struggling, I have a sensation, a literal visceral sensation of like pushing a wheel up a hill. I've lost my train of thought. See, this is what also happens. So with my daughter, she, you know, she looked, when she was three, she looked out the window and there were some crows outside, and she said, "Mumma, the witch birds are calling me, and they want me to go fly with them." And yeah, that's how her brain works. She sees, like, she thinks in story, like, and you know, that's beautiful, and that is, I think, a lesser understood part of it, if you know what I mean. That kind of the way that kind of you look at a flower and see all the patterns in it, and you know, yeah, kind of it's a different way of looking at the world that isn't necessarily, you know, talked about too much.
No, I think that's brilliant. I think that's a great way of describing it, because when we first talked about kind of what is neurodivergence and how is it different to neurotypicality, I think what you've just described in terms of what you've seen and what your daughter saw in terms of the patterns and the shapes rather than the actual flower itself, I think kind of tells as perfectly, and it certainly tells me perfectly. It's one of those ones where when you're talking and you're listening, and now I'm having all sorts of ideas and thoughts about some of the things that I need to look at now, because just that one description telling me that whereas a neurotypical person just sees a flower, a neurodivergent person sees the yellow and the patterns in it and the different sizes of the petals, and it just kind of popped into my head, and it's like, wow, now that's made me understand a lot more how neurodivergent people see the world differently. Because you can always say, you know, yeah, I know that neurodivergent people see the world differently, but until you get an image in your head and understand kind of that difference, which I think your answer just gave me there, it's kind of one of those wow moments, which is fantastic for me, and hopefully great for my students, which will help me when I go back to the class with them. My next question then. Now, obviously, you are not a teacher. So I'm going to give you some things that I think might help a normal student. And do you think that these sorts of things might help a neurodivergent student maybe write creatively? So some of the things that you could do in order to differentiate your teaching in terms of, for me, English, obviously, like giving things like sentence starters, giving out connectives to help connect paragraphs, connect sentences together, pictures. Do you think that those sorts of things would help neurodiverse students too? Or do you think there's more specific things that teachers perhaps could do to help with that creative process, do you think?
I think definitely those are some great ones. And I was trying to remember back to the ones that I had as a kid, and I always used to find them really interesting, like to have kind of those inspirations to kickstart me.
Yeah.
I think that the difficulty is with, again, you know, generalizing greatly, there's the kind of sometimes the difference between the ADHD and the autistic brain. Again, like, no one size fits all, et cetera, but the ADHD brain needs to, like, not always be told what to do so much. And because if they don't like doing it, it's much harder to start anything. And the autistic brain, and I'm talking from my own experience here, needs parameters and boundaries to kind of know, like absolute free writing wouldn't work either, you know, right, for me anyway. So there's the kind of middle ground there, if that makes sense. So I do think a lot of those, you know, I think options are a really good thing, like you say, like perhaps not, you know, the different kind of maybe presenting different options on how to write in one time. Yep. I think also music. I know, and obviously you have to be aware that some autistic people, you know, people who struggle with sensory processing, yep, may find some things distressing. So, you know, that's to kind of be solved with them. But, you know, music is a really good one. I do a workshop with schools sometimes where I've done this with younger children. I'll go in and ask them to close their eyes and they'll listen to a piece of music, and I'll say, like, what does this piece of music, what story does it, and they will kind of come up with this whole story. And it's amazing because you'll have these two students arguing about what, you know, what this one piece of music means that's different to them. Yeah. I know something that my kid's dad has used is like soundscapes. I know was like really kind of immersive stuff, which I know my daughter, for example, and like theatrical side of it, she would like really kind of go from. So I think it's because again, because no one size fits all, it's difficult to know. But I think probably if there's an option to give those options, if you like, yeah, I think that would be really, really helpful.
It is quite interesting. I mean, it's one of the things, obviously, a big topic in schools at the minute is about mobile phones. And one of the things that I think would be, especially with what you said in terms of music, because you've mentioned that a couple of times, and white noise and things that can actually help neurodiverse students to kind of relax, become a little bit more comfortable. It seems to me one thing that we could do in terms of mobile phones, one of the things that perhaps might be a good thing for them to do, and there are obviously downsides to this, which I'll come to in a second, is maybe allowing those neurodivergent students to have their earphones so that when you say, now it's time to write, they can stick their earphones in and they can just block out whatever things are going on in the classroom, and they can just have that music, that white noise, the soundscape, the sound of the sea, whatever it is noise wise that they need in order to help them to be creative. And obviously the downside to that is that everyone else will then want their mobile phones out to be able to actually listen to music, and they'll say, oh yes, I'm only listening to music where, and this, that and the other. How do you feel about it? Do you think that would be a good use of mobile phones in schools, being able to do that for neurodiverse students?
I mean, yeah, I mean, here with the kind of, again, with the caveat that I don't have the answer to the whole students needing it, but I think it would be, you know, because again, now as an adult in the working environment, you know, when I've worked in offices, I couldn't have worked without that at all. Like, I just would have, I would have fallen apart. And it, like, to have that option in school, again, just to kind of find yourself again in this kind of haze of discomfort, I think would help immensely.
Okay, cool. Right, so we're going to come back to the next question after the news. There have been some fantastic answers so far, and I'm really looking forward to coming back, and we'll be back after this.
This is Teachers Talk Radio, and this is Teachers Talk Radio News.
The BBC reported on a long-term study by the Institute of Fiscal Studies, which found children living near Sure Start centres did better at GCSE. The research says these living near a centre performed up to 3 grades better than those living further away. Sure Start began in 1998 to support new parents, especially in disadvantaged areas, but due to austerity, many have since closed. The Department for Education said its Family Hub scheme had a number of advantages over the Sure Start model. The IFS study used postcodes from when children were age 5 to determine proximity to centres and looked at the GCSE results of those children 11 years later. It found what it describes as big improvements in performance in those living near a centre, especially those from low-income backgrounds. Former Prime Minister Gordon Brown, Labour Chancellor at the time the initiative was launched, said the UK now needs a new Sure Start and described the results as what most parents already know, that a supportive environment in early years was life transforming. Among all children in the study, those who live near a Sure Start centre performed better than those who lived far away. But the trend was most pronounced amongst those eligible for free school meals and those from minority ethnic backgrounds. According to The Guardian, schools in England could lose up to £1 billion in funding by 2030, with exceptional falls in pupil numbers prompting closures. Mergers and school closures are already happening in parts of London, where pupil numbers have been falling for some time. According to the think tank Education Policy Institute, the North East is projected to see the greatest decline in primary pupil numbers, down by 13% by 2028 to 29. At secondary school level, Yorkshire and Humber, the North East and London are projected to have the largest falls in pupil numbers, although other areas, including the West Midlands and the South East, have rising numbers. Pupil numbers had grown because of a fertility surge in the 2000s, but as that cohort has moved through, numbers are now falling. Even with increases in per pupil funding, the EPI predicts schools will find it hard to balance budgets as fewer pupils do not lead to reduced costs. The decline is due mainly to a falling birth rate and changing migration patterns. Full details of the EPI projections can be found on the Guardian website. Schools Week reports on the decision by Ofsted to appoint a former chief inspector, Dame Christine Gilbert, to lead the independent inquiry into its response to the death of Ruth Perry. Dame Christine served as the HMCI from 2006 to 2011 and now chairs the Education Endowment Foundation. The Learning Review follows a coroner's ruling in December that an Ofsted inspection contributed to the death of Mrs. Perry, then head teacher of Caversham Primary School. The review will consider actions Ofsted took in response to hearing about the death of Ruth Perry. Dame Christine will have access to relevant records, Ofsted staff, and the opportunity to meet with Ruth Perry's family as part of the review. The review will not examine the November 2022 inspection of Caversham Primary. Teaching unions have expressed concern about the appointment of Gilbert, saying it was critical that the review was robust, independent, and impartial, and that some would rightly question the notion of a former HMCI reviewing the work of Ofsted. A report will be completed after the review and recommendations will focus on future actions. Schools Week also reports on a plan for the Department for Education to work with the Scout Association to provide 40,000 explorers, those aged 14 to 18, with the skills and knowledge they need to consider a career in teaching. The DfE will work with the Scouts to create age-appropriate activities that inspire young people to consider a career in teaching, linking to relevant badges and awards. It did, however, clarify that there are currently no plans for a teaching badge. The policy is part of the DfE's Get Into Teaching plan, which aims to elevate the status of the profession and target new audiences who have not yet considered teaching as a career. The scheme will launch in September and it is hoped that it will reach 40,000 young people. The Scouts will create support and guidance material for those running the programme. The initial one-year contract is worth £43,000, but can be extended subject to budget availability. Finally, a teenager who campaigned for skateboarding to be included in school qualifications is proud to see it added to the list of approved GCSE sports in Wales. According to the report on the BBC News website, Qualifications Wales has added 13 new sports to the approved list for GCSE PE. Other newly allowed sports include BMX, shooting, kickboxing and wakeboarding. The new Made for Wales GCSE in Physical Education and Health will be available for first teaching from September 2026. The change makes Wales the second UK nation to include skateboarding, behind Northern Ireland. This has been your Teachers Talk Radio News with Joe Fox.
And welcome back to the show. Quite an interesting one there. GCSE Sport in Wales would like shooting brought in. Fantastic. Give a teenager a gun. What a great way to start GCSE PE. Right. So talking about neurodiversity then with Emily Randall-Jones, a fantastic award-winning author. So we've just talked then, Emily, about the kind of the things that we can do to help that creative process. So our next question then, we've kind of covered a lot of this, but this might be kind of other different ways, you know, but how could a teacher help a neurodiverse student to write more creatively?
Like you said, we've come up with some kind of some ideas there, I think, which is great. I think, you know, one thing that I, and it's kind of probably answering your next question as well, to be honest, one thing that I do, and one thing I've kind of done with my neurodivergent writers group, is, and I've taken it into schools as well, is creating something called a story patchwork quilt, which is a strange thing, but bear with me. It's it's basically the idea that every story that you write, you know, every kind of book you read by any author is literally just bits of you, you know, your memories, yep. your experiences, your feelings and all that kind of stuff. And you can kind of pick and choose from your, you know, from your patchwork quilt and kind of blend them to make a story. So, for example, on my patchwork quilt, I will have something like, you know, a place that I love, like I've gone on holiday. I don't know, say Nottingham, for example. I've never actually been to Nottingham, but, you know, that could be, you know, that could be a thing. You know, something that is my special interest. So, you know, there could be the Titanic once upon a time, there'd have been the Titanic. Okay. You know, a big feeling that I've had, which, you know, is quite often, you know, feeling like I don't fit in. Perhaps a TV show that I like, so I like the humour of it. So, for example, like for me, it'd be like BBC Ghosts, that kind of thing. And, you know, write down as many of these as possible and make your patchwork quilt. And again, it's just a way of encouraging the students to dig deep within themselves to find things that they love, and to create those stories in a kind of personal sense. And for neurodivergent people that do have special interests or hyperfocuses, that's a really good way of bringing that into the work. I think the other thing to really be aware of is RSD, which is rejection sensitive dysphoria. I don't know how much you guys have done with that as teachers, but that what can be perceived as, you know, I think what is thought to be kind of like, things can be taken really personally as a neurodivergent person, because we have kind of years of not feeling like we do things wrong. Sometimes the slightest, like not what's the word I'm looking for? What we see is the slightest kind of criticism, which is, you know, actually just normal teaching, can set us back. And they're like, well, I can't do it anymore. I'm a failure. I'm this and I'm that. And I think, even though I'm not kind of encouraging walking on eggshells or anything, I think being aware and choosing words carefully and feedback carefully in such a way that is that is perhaps gentler, because it can, you know, words can affect a whole performance, basically.
So what you're saying is that sometimes we have to be careful the words we're using around neurodivergent students, because just a tiny little wrong remark can make a neurodiverse student shut down and say, that's it, I'm finished, I'm not doing any more.
Pretty much. And then, you know, you've got so many profiles of kind of neurodiversity. You've got like PDA, so pathological demand avoidance, which is another kind of profile of autism. And it's really difficult to kind of try and, you know, think of all these things under this umbrella. You know, and obviously speaking literally as well, for a lot of autistic people, we do take things very much at face value and don't understand subtext particularly well. And I think, you know, being aware of that and, you know, choosing the language that you use, whatever that looks like with neurodivergent children, is, I think, a kind of a key way to get their buy-in, I suppose.
Okay, cool. We'll be back in a second.
I've always considered myself to be a caring head teacher who acts sensitively to support staff mental health. But what I found increasingly difficult was managing the negative impact on staff mental health when resolving issues related to their employment or daily work. Heartfelt Leadership has been developed by TeachWell Toolkit as a handbook to support head teachers to overcome the challenges of school improvement while supporting staff well-being. We know that difficult conversations can quickly turn into conflict if procedures are not fully transparent, understood, and followed. Our handbook takes you through step-by-step processes while maintaining mutual respect, avoiding conflict, and finding solutions.
At Bloomsbury Education, we're passionate about supporting teachers with high-quality professional development books from leading experts. Whether you're navigating your first crucial years as an early career teacher or a more experienced teacher looking to refresh your practice or take a step up into leadership, our award-winning books are here to help. We publish practical books to support teaching across primary and secondary, from the very best in research-led practice to trusted advice on inclusivity, behaviour and curriculum design. Visit the Bloomsbury Education website at bloomsbury.com/education to find out more and use code BLOOMTTR24 to save 20% on all education titles. Bloomsbury Education, books for every step of your teaching journey.
And we're back again with Emily Randall-Jones, talking about neurodiversity. So we've just talked about some of the techniques that you can use to help write more creatively. So we've got one of your ones, which is the patchwork quilt, which I think is absolutely brilliant. Are there any other things that you do as an author that may be a good way for teachers to help neurodiverse students?
I'm trying to have a little think. So you've mentioned a lot of them. So yeah, white noise, or yeah. Or kind of themed. You know, you get kind of like sleep sounds. You get on a lot of like meditation apps and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
You get things like heavy rain or your train sounds or
yeah,
you know, rainforests or what have you. Like if there's anything that's kind of themed, it's kind of like a soundscape but themed to your work. That's very helpful. Kind of talked yeah. about body doubling as well. Like you know. Making that you're kind of working with someone else, and so you're being almost being held accountable, feeling more comfortable. I think that's you know I think that's a fantastic thing to do. And again, you know, being aware of those different kind of processes, that those verbal processes, I think are really helpful. Yeah, like I said before, the difficulty is that kind of midway between needing the parameters and needing the freedom to write as well. It's a difficult one. I don't envy teachers that have to kind of adapt all their work with these kind of huge classes that each very individual needs, neurodivergent or not.
It is incredibly difficult. I think even the word differentiation has gone out of has gone out of style now. I think it's called something else. I have no idea what though. So my next question to then is and I think you've certainly given me one of these. Is can the creative process be a trigger for neurodiverse students? Do you think?
I mean the answer is like. One size fits all again, I suppose. Yeah. But I think it can be. If your brain doesn't work in that way, I think it can be incredibly distressing. If you are struggling, you know, if you are very, very literal as a person, you know, perhaps needing to do something a bit more creative feels very uncomfortable. Also, if it's something you don't want to do, that can be very, very difficult. And that kind of loss of autonomy can be very difficult for a neurodivergent students, you know, if you have to do something with very, very strict parameters, that can be difficult. And I think also one thing that I found as a professional writer is, you know, this thing that I love, but I have to do it, you know, now that can sometimes take away the joy, which can be very distressing as well. You know, so it's a fine balance to try and find, I think.
Okay, so my next question then is kind of linked to that, I suppose. Do you think that the uniqueness of the neurodiverse brain is kind of more or less attuned to the creative process than those who are neurotypical? Do you think?
I do think, and again, this is I'm generalizing, but you yeah. kind of. You look, you know, you look, there's all, obviously we can't say for certain the people in the past, but, you know, autistic or ADHD or what have you, but there are so many theories that a lot of people who are, because some of our most amazing, you know, life-changing creatives and artists and musicians yeah. are neurodivergent. And that's, you know, I think that's because of the way our brain works. We don't go from A to B. And that's what, you know, there's a lot of talk about whether or not this should be seen as a superpower, which can be quite, I think upsetting for, you know, unpassable for people who this is very, you know, life altering, and that it's, you know, yeah. there are people who really, it's a spectrum, and there are people who have, you know, much more kind of a high needs than others. But the one thing that I do love about being neurodivergent is the way that I don't just see the world as black and white. I can see, yeah. you know, I can see the wonder in things in a way that I feel like I wouldn't be able to if I was neurotypical. And one thing I was going to say is, if you ever watched the TV show Taskmaster, the Sue Perkin series, I didn't even realize she was ADHD before, but I had to look it up because I was like, she has to be. When she's given a task, like honestly, if you want to see how the ADHD brain works, it's amazing. When she's given a task to do, the first thing she goes is like, how can I approach this differently? And she does it like completely different from everyone else. And she like, she'll succeed 99% of the time.
Yeah.
But she's done it in a unique way. So I think that actually speaks volumes more than my words can. as to how that kind of creative brain works.
Okay, brilliant. I think I also remember, if going back to something you said earlier, right, about how your daughter sees not just the flower, but the patterns and the little shadows and everything else, and sees the individual petals. I think that also has helped me to understand the kind of how unique, in terms of the creative process, that the neurodiverse brain can be. I think that image is really sticking in my mind. That's something I've definitely I've got down on there. But seeing those patterns, seeing it differently in a weird way. I'm trying my hardest to remember, but I know that when you said it was a superpower, there was just something that popped into my brain about something I'd watched, but I can't remember it. So I'm going to have to leave it. I was trying desperately to remember what someone had said, because it was an autistic lady that said that she found it really horrible when people said, oh, no, it's a superpower. And it's like, well, no, it isn't.
Yeah, it's one of the kind of really hotly debated things that it's a disability, a lot of people, you know, it's disabling for a lot of people.
Yeah.
And that can't be kind of underestimated. But like there are ways that, before I even knew that I was neurodivergent, that I liked about how my brain worked, and I wouldn't want to change that. I don't think I'd be a writer without it.
Yeah, I think it's certainly in terms of what you just said there, it's with it being a disability. I think sometimes by giving it things like, it's a superpower, kind of negates that sense that this is a really debilitating thing sometimes, and can really make people feel anxious and alone and desperate sometimes. And I think giving them terms like superpower, I think sometimes negates that, and it kind of makes it into something that people think is just is a happy thing for them, so to speak. If you know what I mean.
I tell you, and I couldn't agree more, because it is, you know, I don't want to leave the point too much, but it is, you know, it can be incredibly debilitating and incredibly frustrating. It's not just a kind of sort of, you know, even after I was diagnosed, sometimes I forget that I have to give myself accommodations, because I'm pushing myself so hard, and like not being, you actually can't, and realizing that your brain can't work to the way society kind of demands a little bit is really tough.
Yeah. Okay, so for this next question, I'm going to describe my classroom, or one of my classrooms. I have two, because in my classroom, I have like two sets of huge windows, and one looks on the car park, one looks onto kind of the playground. And then I've got a wall on one side, and then I've got a whiteboard, and then I've got desks kind of going backwards. And I've also got obviously a door, which has got a glass window, which you can see through and see into the classroom. So in terms of maybe that classroom, and that it doesn't have to be a typical classroom, but do you think that there's somewhere a neurodiverse student is placed in the classroom, i.e. where they sit, could help that student with the creative writing process or non-fiction writing process?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you know, again, it's a question of each individual person, of what they kind of like. I would always like to be near the door or the window, so I didn't feel like I was hemmed in. You know, I get quite distressed if I feel like I'm trapped somewhere. So, like in the kind of, you know, the middle of it, I would have felt very difficult, very hard.
Yeah.
But I also know, as an ADHD person, if I was near a playground, I would be out looking at the window, you know, like wondering, sort of, you know, how the swing was, well, look, it was moving by itself, or, you know, like it was a bit rusty or what have you. You know, so it's. You're being at the back, for example, where I was kind of away from everybody else, but then maybe I would find it harder to focus on what was being said up the front. So it's a really difficult one, because I'm sure it's different for each person. But yes, I think finding that sweet spot, whatever that looks like, and again, that's probably down to the student to kind of pinpoint and try and share, you know, in however that works, but what works for them, I think, is, and advocating for themselves in that way is really helpful.
Okay, so I think what you're saying is it's probably a good idea to have a conversation with your neurodiverse students, and in terms of where they sit in the seating plan in the class, because that could help them not only in terms of the creative process, but just in terms of how anxious they feel and kind of how comfortable they feel in your classroom.
Totally. And I'd say that with all aspects of things, like, you know, having those conversations if it's possible and you have the capacity, because neurodiversity quite often, as we've kind of talked about, doesn't look like you think it does, not that you won, you know, having those conversations, being like, what, you know, what do you find distressing? What don't you find distressing? And wherever that is possible to kind of make those accommodations, is going to make, you know, their ability to work so much easier.
Okay, fantastic. So we've come to my last question, and it's been such a fantastic conversation that we've had. If you could have one wish regarding neurodiversity, and it doesn't have to be about education or an educational setting, what would it be?
I think it would be kind of like society as a whole, I guess, which is the big answer. But I think, you know, you do, like, growing up, there is this kind of, you see, again, one sees sort of achievements and life being a certain way, and this is what it looks like if you're doing well. You know, you get to a point where, you know, you're married, you have kids or whatever, or you have a job, you get, you know, you make more and more money, you kind of get a bigger house, you buy a house, you go on holidays, all this kind of stuff, all of which is great if that's what you want, and if that works for you. But I've come to a realization now, at the age that I am, that my life isn't going to look like that, I have to unlearn a lot of stuff about what success and happiness looks like.
Yeah.
And I think if success and happiness was measured differently, if there was a much more open society where, like, you know, money wasn't so important, you know, I'm going down the whole kind of thing, and it was much less kind of linear thing, if productivity wasn't as valued as it was as happiness, that all of that, I think it's just, because I don't think neurodivergent people, you know, a lot of the time, there's, you know, like, well, there is nothing wrong with us. We are not broken. Yeah. We are not wrong. We are in a society that we don't necessarily work in. And when I don't think we're the ones that have to change.
I absolutely agree. I think that's a great answer. Because I think even for neurotypical people, I think sometimes what constitutes success is different for everyone, and certainly when your brain is wired differently, and you see the world differently, that success needs to be different, and I think that needs to be accepted more with a lot of people. So let's see if I can summarize what we've talked about this today. So we've talked about one of the things that that teachers can do in terms of learning about neurodiversity is probably a good idea to get students to learn about themselves and about their own neurodiversity to help themselves, as well as teachers kind of having a bit of their own knowledge as well. We've talked about the challenges, such as the noises, the sensory issues, the temperatures, conformity. So how all of that, on top of every other bit aspect of kind of teenage life and student life, makes it far harder and far more challenging for neurodiverse students. We've talked about the sorts of things that can help students write creatively, things that might affect a student to write a fiction piece. So immersing your piece, having going to the library, having bringing something in to make your classroom a little bit more personal, so that they've got things that they can make them comfortable, working in pairs, listening to music. Then we talked about there's no one size fits all in terms of non-fiction or fiction. And I kind of found out some of my own biases on that one, if I remember correctly. Then we had the creative techniques, which I thought was brilliant. Talked about parameters, sometimes having options, perhaps doing some theatrical things, or maybe having the soundscapes or music on a little bit. Then we talked about something a teacher can do to help neurodiverse students, and you talked about that brilliant patchwork quilt of your everyday life, of what makes you, and trying to draw out some of the things that helps them to write, but also other things like, again, the white noise, the sounds, pairing people up, followed by the creative person, the things that can trigger people is some people are more literal, but again, it's not one size fits all. And we also talked, I think, on the previous question about how Watch your language in terms of neurodiverse people, because it could trigger a shutdown. I definitely remember that's one thing I'm going to remember and take with me. Then we talked about the uniqueness of the neurodiverse brain and how that difference in the rewiring makes people can be much more creative, because as you said with your daughter doesn't see a flower, she sees the patterns and the colours and everything else, and that can make the neurodiverse brain much more unique. Then we talked about situations in a classroom where people might sit and maybe having a conversation with students about where they might want to sit, because you might, an ADHD person might want to sit at the near to the door, but might not want to sit next to a window, because if looking out in the playground, they might be get distracted. And then also the biggest wish that you would like is so that success, the things that we measure success in, would be different and society could change it so that it could maybe include the things that neurodiversity can acquire as well. I think I covered everything there, didn't I?
You did great.
Brilliant. Well, it has been an absolute pleasure talking to you, and I have learnt a lot tonight, and I have taken about 5 pages worth of notes about the things that we've talked about, because I've learned loads of things that I can take into the classroom, and I can I think one of the things I'm going to start doing literally from next week is I'm going to talk a lot more to those neurodivergent students in my class, just to see what I can do to make them more comfortable. But yeah, it's been absolutely brilliant. Thank you ever so much for being on the show.
Thank you for having me. I've had a lovely time.
That's brilliant. And hopefully at some point in the future, I will try and talk to you again, because I think there's so much more to cover with this and about neurodivergence and students and all the rest of it. So I will leave you for tonight and say thank you very much. And you can now go away and perhaps relax for the weekend. Hopefully your daughter won't wake you up at 4 o'clock again. or your kids. Fingers crossed. Have a great weekend. And hopefully I will speak to you soon. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Cheers. Bye-bye. And that's it for tonight. Thank you for joining me on Teacher Talk Radio. It's been fantastic talking to Emily Randall-Jones, award-winning author and neurodivergent, who's given me loads of ideas. And I hope you've been inspired as well to look at your neurodivergent students in a different way, and perhaps look at things differently and see how we can help them. Until next week, not next week, I'm not going to be back for 2 weeks. And until then, have a great weekend.
You've been listening to Teachers Talk Radio. Tune in live and listen back at ttradio.org. We look forward to hearing from you next time on Teachers Talk Radio.